Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford and Leo Laporte, episode number 27 for Friday, December 18th, 2009. New directions for multiple sclerosis research.
Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by the new voice-activated Sync, featuring hands-free calling, music search, and turn-by-turn navigation, available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford and Leo Laporte.
Hello, Dr. Kiki.
Hello.
I should be your stupid sidekick.
You're not stupid.
Don't you need like the stupid sidekick?
Oh, Dr. Kiki, hi. What is science?
No.
No?
No.
That's what they usually have on one of these shows. A numbskull.
I play both those parts myself.
You're the bird brain.
The bird brain, that's right. This is episode number 27, and today we're talking about multiple sclerosis and the science of figuring out what is actually going on with this disease. Multiple sclerosis is also known as MS, and it's an autoimmune disorder in which the body's immune system actually attacks the myelin sheath, the coating that insulates our nerves. And it usually keeps our nerves transmitting those electrical signals that let us move and talk and think and do everything really smoothly. But when the body attacks them, the sheath turns into scar tissue or a plaque or a sclerosis, and you end up with problems with the propagation of those electrical signals. And so people with multiple sclerosis end up having movement disorders, problems with their sight, vision, all anything that is dependent upon these electrical signals can be affected. And there's a prevalence range, according to Wikipedia, anywhere between 2 and 150 people per 100,000. That's a pretty wide range. But it is very prevalent. The United States is, and the North American continent has a fairly high prevalence compared to other countries in the world. And today we're going to talk about what's going on in the research community, figuring out what we know about multiple sclerosis, looking at the research paths to figure out more about it, and also to potentially figure out treatments for the future. And we're joined today by Dr. Kumar Hari, who is the director of discovery biology at the Myelin Repair Foundation, which is located in Saratoga, California. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Kiki. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, the Myelin Repair Foundation, can you tell us a little bit about what you do there specifically?
Sure. So the Myelin Repair Foundation began as a concept back in 2002, largely driven by its founder, Scott Johnson, who was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, over 20 years ago. And at the time, it took a while for him to decide that he really wanted to focus in on finding new therapeutics for the disease. But what he really recognized at the time was how long it was taking to bring new therapies to market. And he decided that that was a challenge he really wanted to combat. So in setting up the Myelin Repair Foundation, he really needed to identify where the major roadblocks were. And what he recognized was that, first of all, there's a lot that's not known about the basic biology of the sheath that you described earlier, the myelin sheath, which surrounds nerve cells and protects the electrical conductance along the nerves. But second of all, he recognized that even when basic biology discoveries were being made, there was a real roadblock in being able to translate those discoveries into pharmaceutical therapies. And so that's really the area of concern that he focused the most on, and it's where the Myelin Repair Foundation hopes to have the most progress.
Where do you think it stands, the state of research stands currently? My mother is diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. I remember when she was diagnosed, okay. it was going to be like 30 years before there was a treatment or a therapy. Is that kind of length of time what we're still looking at? And how is the Myelin Repair Foundation working to make that shorter if it is still that long?
Right. Well, we certainly hope that 30-year time horizon is no longer the case. I think coming from an academic background as you do and as I do, you know, we typically hear that the time frame for bringing new therapies to market is somewhere of order 10 years. But I think it really does depend on the state of the basic biology. It really does depend on how far current treatments have come. And so if we look in the field of multiple sclerosis, a lot of the FDA-approved therapies really have to do with one aspect of the disease. And so trying to bring newer therapies to market, ones that focus specifically on repairing damaged myelin, is really the focus of the Myelin Repair Foundation. Mm-hmm. And the thought process there is, if we're able to combat multiple aspects of this complex disease, we can really have a much more effective collection of therapies that are out on the market.
Can you tell us, what do we know currently about the biology of myelin? How much do we know?
Sure. So that it's complicated.
Yeah.
if we consider the sheath itself, though, I mean, we know that it's made up predominantly of lipids, maybe about 80%, and then about 20% of that sheath is protein itself. We know, again, that the sheath is required to protect nerves, both in the central nervous system as well as the peripheral nervous system, protect their conductive properties. We even know quite a bit about the way that the electrical signals get sent down the axons of the nerves, which are the long spines of the nerves, which is by a process called saltatory conduction. It's essentially jumping of the electrical currents. And when the myelin sheath is destroyed, you lose the efficiency of that jumping process. And so while there is some residual conductance within those nerves, you don't get, as you said earlier, the swiftness of that process. And so that's what leads to a lot of these symptoms that patients face, including, you know, tingling in their extremities, some of the optic defects that occur in patients. And so So a lot is known about the basic composition of myelin. A lot is known about what happens when degeneration occurs and its function is impaired. There's quite a bit known about the process that cells are using to attack the myelin. And as you mentioned, it's thought to be an autoimmune process where it's really the body attacking itself and attacking the myelin as the target of its venom, if you will. But really, the basic biology, how one cell contacts another to make the myelin and really rebuild and protect the electrical conductance around the nerve is still a wide open area of study. And it's really a complicated process. There are a lot of different cell types involved. And in fact, when you get into situations where we're talking about immune attacks against the body, you bring in yet another layer of cells that have a really major impact on how the nerves are functioning.
Are you looking at all at what triggers, what internal kinds of signaling might be going on to actually tell the body that, hey, you should punch me, you know, hey, immune system, come beat me up? I mean, what's going on there?
It's a great question. And in fact, there isn't conclusive evidence today that tells us what some definitive trigger might be. You know, one of the going theories really has to do with what a lot of people are calling molecular mimicry. That is, the body is recognizing the myelin as something foreign because there's something about the myelin that in its past it had recognized as foreign. So what might be the trigger for that? You know, one thought is that there are maybe certain viruses that infected the body that stimulate this response to self. But the data is quite inconclusive. I think there are some studies now where people have looked at individual cells trying to identify a virus that is the trigger, and it's really it's hard to know right now. The jury's still out on where the trigger really lies.
Yeah, and that's kind of the case for a lot of these autoimmune diseases where you have like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and multiple sclerosis and many others where the immune system just starts attacking the body. It starts doing something happens, and it seems like, I mean, these are all different diseases, but I mean, are people thinking there's some kind of link between them, or is there anything that's suggesting that?
Are, and it gets, you know, even more wild than some of the diseases you described. I mean, if you just consider people with peanut allergies or people with dermatitis, I mean, these are all at some level immune system defects, and it's very difficult to know why the immune system becomes hypersensitive. I mean, you know, the current topic of the day, H1N1 infections, it's really unknown why people with very healthy immune systems are having such a dramatic negative reaction to having this virus. But in fact, healthy people are the ones who appear to be the most afflicted by H1N1. So again, the triggers are really unclear why the system gets hyperstimulated. But you brought up a really good question about overlap in disease, and there is some genetic evidence suggesting that there are corollaries between different autoimmune diseases. And I think there was one paper published in New England Journal of Medicine a few years back that even talked about markers of type 1 diabetes that appeared to overlap with genetic markers in multiple sclerosis patients. But for MS, the real take home is the correlation to genetics is spotty at best. You can look at monozygotic and dizygotic twins and see some evidence of correlation, but if you go out to the general population, that correlation really falls off.
Yeah. So somebody in the chat room here was asking about HLA phenotypes. Is there anything?
Yeah. So that's really the major one. There is a human leukocyte antigen and an allele of that antigen, which is found on the surface of the cells, called DR2. And that today for MS patients appears to be the one that's most correlated with disease. But again, I think even in twin studies, the height of that correlation is, you know, up in the 25% to 30% range. So, and not something that we could point our finger at and really drive the studies, although very good in terms of trying to come up with early stage predictive values.
Right. So it's a kind of thing where if you went and had your gene sequence, your genome sequenced, which is getting more and more feasible these days, and you found that you have a particular allele for that's correlated with a higher propensity for multiple sclerosis or one of these autoimmune diseases, it's predictive, but not necessarily.
That's right. And in fact, you know, diagnosis of multiple sclerosis is such a tricky deal that really people are still relying to large degree on clinical signs and clinical symptoms. So relapses.
Really, there's no test for it, for instance.
There's no single test for multiple sclerosis today. There are a lot of studies now surrounding, you know, what are called biomarkers for disease, where people are really trying to identify single proteins or patterns of proteins or even changes in certain proteins in the body that correlate with disease. But again, no straight predictor that's out on the market today. Really, MRI is being used as a marker, an imaging marker for diagnosis, and while it's quite good and it's been very useful in clinical studies and as a diagnostic, as a predictor, we hope that we can do better.
In terms of the research directions that you're looking at right now, what directions? You mentioned myelin repair earlier, so I'm assuming that's looking at people who have multiple sclerosis. They have damage to their myelin, and it's not necessarily stopping the body from attacking the myelin, but instead repairing it once it's been damaged?
Right. So this is where we think a lot about what aspects of our therapeutic intervention or therapeutic interventions that exist for patients will really prove themselves to be myelin reparative. So if you could stop the attack, ongoing attack, which is what's happening with a lot of the currently approved therapies, they're all immunosuppressive reagents. And it turns out that the body, you know, as most patients with relapsing remitting courses know, can repair itself pretty well. well. The problem is when those attacks are accumulative and progress over time, then you start getting into problems with injury to the nerve cells themselves. And that's where we hope that myelin reparative therapies can really block that particular injurious action. So really the line of research for the principal investigators who are involved with the Myelin Repair Foundation has to do with both aspects of disease, both the immune system component as well as the basic biology of myelination, and trying to either stimulate normally reparative processes or figure out how to fix them when they've been broken.
So are you finding, have you already located or found any of these reparative processes, the internal processes that naturally go into repairing the myelin?
Well, again, this is another, it's a difficult question. Again, when we set up the Myelin Repair Foundation, it was pretty clear that there wasn't a whole lot known about the basic processes of myelination. And so it's quite interesting. Scott Johnson, as sort of an entrepreneur in the Silicon Valley, he hadn't had a detailed PhD training in science or anything like that. But he went to a scientific conference, the Myelin Gordon Conference, and really talked to people and tried to figure out where the current state of research was. And I think he recognized at an early stage that there needed to be support for the basic biology, in addition to trying to figure out how therapies could be made possible through that line of research. And so, I mean, I should mention in terms of the Myelin Repair Foundation, there are four principal investigators that work with the consortium currently. Ben Barris at Stanford University, Brian Popko at the University of Chicago, Robert Miller at Case Western Reserve University, and Stephen Miller at Northwestern University. And these four and their laboratories, the students, the postdocs, the technicians who do all the work, they really are the engine for the Myelin Repair Foundation. And it's been a great consortium, great work to get them all collaborating and trying to answer these questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything that you're finding, where's the state of your research now? Like, what are some really exciting results that you've had recently that, you know, just have you all very excited, the people you've just mentioned and people at the Myelin Repair Foundation just excited about?
Yeah, I'd probably put them in three categories. So, I mean, I'd start with some of the basic processes of myelination. Two of the labs have been able to find two genes in mice that, when mutated, appear to be these master regulators of the myelination process. And, you know, they're typical master regulators. They have effects on lots of downstream other genes. And so that line of study will hopefully bring us into an area where we can be more specific about the types of targets from a pharmaceutical perspective that we would want to promote into development and really try to identify drug modifying therapies against. So that's the first line. It's again, from the basic perspective, genes like that hadn't been recognized in earlier research. The second line of really exciting data has to do with part of the basic process of multiple sclerosis, which is creating holes within the blood-brain barrier, which allows immune cells to enter the central nervous system. I mean, this is, in fact, one of the modifying therapies on the market today, Tysabri. Its mechanism of action is meant to keep those inflammatory cells from crossing the blood-brain barrier and entering the CNS.
Right, and the issue with them crossing the blood-brain barrier, normally the blood-brain barrier is a barrier so that it protects all the important cellular machinery inside of the brain from any kind of infection or damage. And so when
that's right.
Yeah. And if these immune cells get in and they start damaging the myelin on your central nervous system, I mean, that's where problems really start to happen, right?
That's exactly right. And that barrier that you described, there's some thought that that barrier allows the central nervous system to be what's often considered immunoprivileged, so that you don't get this hyper-stimulative immune response within the central nervous system. I think one of the interesting things that we're finding with the blood-brain barrier are the types of cells that are involved in creating that barrier, and also how those cells are interacting with the blood vessel and the vasculatures within the blood-brain barrier to keep it sort of keep its integration intact. So that's a really interesting line of study going on with MRF, again, from a basic biology perspective. And I think the third area of study, which has got us really excited, is sort of a little outside the realm of basic biology and more towards the realm of trying to translate these discoveries into programs that pharmaceutical companies would be really interested in to pick up and carry forward. And this has to do with the animal models that are used to test these agents for their effects in disease modifying action. And the gold standard for multiple sclerosis in terms of doing testing in animals is our mouse models of what's called experimental allergic encephalomyelitis, or EAE. And this is essentially a model where one stimulates an allergic reaction within the animal that's guided towards the myelin sheath. And it recapitulates a lot of the symptoms of human disease, including relapsing courses or chronic courses, or just a lot of the ways that the immune system would react to being hyperstimulated against the myelin proteins. But it's an interesting model in that, again, it's the gold standard. It's the one that industry uses quite often in terms of doing their own drug development. But a lot of therapies that appear to be active in combating EAE in animal models have no effect in humans. And so there's a real need for coming up with new models of multiple sclerosis in animals so that early stage discoveries can be measured. And we've come up with two different animal models now that don't rely specifically on stimulating the immune system. And what that allows us to do is study specifically the role of the cells in the central nervous system and their ability to repair, not only on their own, but also perhaps our ability to stimulate that process when damage has occurred. So those are three exciting areas of research going on at MRF right now.
Yeah, they sound really exciting. The really interesting stuff there. I mean, from the blood-brain barrier research, I mean, that has implications. I mean, if you understand more about how the blood-brain barrier works and how it interacts with immune cells and even other cellular types, it goes a long way toward understanding what would allow it to open up. You know, how are these holes forming in the blood-brain barrier to allow immune cells through? Understanding that could even be translated and applied to pharmaceuticals, where in the pharmaceutical industry, there's often drug delivery that you want to get into the brain, but you can't get it there because of the blood-brain barrier. So that even beyond just understanding it for multiple sclerosis's sake, there's a basic understanding there that can go have a lot broader reach.
Yeah, you really hit the
nail on the head. And then in terms of the animal models, I'm just thinking that figuring out why certain animal models, you know, don't react to the treatments that seem to help people, is it just because of the genetics of the animal are different? What's actually happening? Are we not actually modeling the disease even though the symptoms look the same?
Yeah, those are all great questions. I mean, there are aspects of the length of disease courses in the animal models that probably don't predict what's going on in humans. Mm-hmm. There are aspects of a process really that Steve Miller at Northwestern has worked on throughout his career known as epitope spreading. And it's kind of a complicated idea, but essentially, you know, the part of the protein that your body first reacts to might be different from the part of the protein that your body reacts to in subsequent relapses. And so there is a question about how much these models of EAE in mice recapitulate that particular activity in humans. It appears that it might, but there's a lot more study that would need to be done.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And the fact there are multiple forms of multiple sclerosis as well. So you've mentioned the relapsing remitting form where you get sick and then your body fixes itself and you get better and you don't have the tingling, you don't have the loss of motion any of those issues. But then there's also more progressive forms. And so you have primary progressive, you have secondary progressive, where primary progressive is just progressive all the way along. You don't really have, you might, or secondary progressive, you might start out with what seems to be a relapsing remitting, but actually there's just damage building up and you're just getting worse and worse and worse. I'm just wondering if you find those different phenotypes in the animal models, if there is, you know, if there are certain genotypes that underlie the way that the body actually reacts to the assault on the nervous system, and then how that actually plays out.
Right. That's interesting. You know, the genotype aspect of that. I mean, there are certain strains of mice that probably react differently to the stimulant. But in terms of being able to reproduce, let's say, a relapsing remitting course versus a chronic course, you can certainly do that in the mouse models. It has more to do with how you stimulate the reaction than maybe specifically about the strain of mice. But I think it's an open area of study to try to figure out how correctly those mouse models recapitulate the human disease courses.
Yeah.
And I think even in the human state, it's very difficult to know, let's say, when a person who presents for the relapsing remitting course, whether they may or may not progress to a secondary progressive state. It's even difficult in the humans to know when that might occur.
Right. Right. Absolutely. I'm also thinking about these different types of I guess how the multiple sclerosis actually is expressed in different people, and you know, the different treatments and how what we're using now. They seem to be, since we know it's an immune disease disorder, we're using kind of these gross immune system modulating treatments, or we know it's inflammatory, so let's give you an anti-inflammatory. But there's nothing actually specific that we're not able to really, you know, we're not able to pinpoint it. We're not getting there with like the laser beam focus of knowing exactly what we can target and how to fix it. In terms of the research directions that that different groups are going, I mean, what do you think is driving the different research focuses and getting to certain solutions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I can certainly speak to it from the Myelin Repair Foundation perspective, which is while the immune system modulators certainly appear to be efficacious in a subset of the patients who take them, we just fully believe that there has to be some component of repair that allows damage that isn't fully resolved to be resolved. And that is the way to get patients back to sort of a ground zero state, because that damage just continues to accumulate, in patients who do receive those immune modulating therapies, although it's pretty variable who responds and how well they respond.
Right.
I think a lot of the field, it's quite interesting that there's a lot of studies coming out now where people are looking at adult stem cell therapies and their ability to stimulate repair in the central nervous system. And there's some good data there where early clinical trials appear to be showing positive effects. I think that comes with a lot of attendant issues with people's own thoughts about stem cells and their ability to repair. There's also some basic questions about, is it the stem cell itself or something that the stem cell is secreting? Because again, the body has an ability to repair, and we see that not only in these patient courses, but also in the animal models that we're working on. And I think if we can get to that point where we're stimulating repair before the amount of injury sort of overtakes the body's ability to affect that repair, we'd be in really good shape. So I see those as two general courses that the field is taking.
We have a lot of comments in the chat room about various kind of ancillary ancillary, yeah, I guess that works, ancillary issues to do with MS and research and treatment. One of the things that that I've seen on the web, I mean, there you go on the web and there it's like any topic. There's all these things, bee sting therapy. If you have vitamin D, you'll be fine. If you, you know, smoke a little weed, that'll help. You know, coming from a research perspective, going from, you know, as a scientist looking into how the body works, how the body's attacking itself, how it's reacting to those attacks, and how we can stop that, fix it, et cetera. You know, what do you tell the average person who's looking on the web for something, you know, to help them out?
Boy, that's a difficult one.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. You and I share a couple things, which I realized earlier today. I mean, the first is we were both research techs at UC Davis, so that's go
that's right.
Aggs. The second, though, is, you know, I also have a family member who is affected by multiple sclerosis, which, of course, affects the whole family.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to know what to say when. You know, from a science background, every academic discovery is, you know, the next silver bullet. And I think it's incumbent upon scientists, and I know a lot of people are probably not going to be happy with this line of response, but I think it's incumbent upon, you know, the academic scientists and the scientific community to make people aware that the goal of these therapies is not only to solve disease, but it's to be safe, and we need to be as effective as possible at the same time that we're treating people in a safe manner. And so I have mixed feelings about this myself. I think the academic research that we do is so incredibly important just to understanding the basic processes going on when two cells talk to one another.
Yeah.
But I think to translate that into something
meaningful,
something meaningful and into a therapy that we would use to help a patient. We all want that to go as fast as humanly possible. And I see, again, all the postdocs and graduate students and technicians working in the laboratories associated with MRF, they're all burning the midnight oil, trying to make this happen as fast as possible. But also in with as careful science as we can do and in the safest manner possible. And I think, you know, we as scientists, it's our responsibility to manage those expectations. We have to manage and balance those two things for patients who they don't want to go to their PhDs and figure this out, right? They want treatments now, and so do we. And we're doing our very best and working as hard as we possibly can to make that happen.
Great. Do we want to go to Twalkin and
have
maybe
some
ask
calls?
Some?
Yeah,
some,
I'd love to
questions.
Get more Twalkin calls,
know.
Though. If people are listening, they can call Twalkin at 218-548-9255. The PIN is 1304, and then you hit the pound sign, but they walk you through that. J.K. Powers has been very patient, hanging on the line.
Hanging on the line.
Hi, J.K. Powers. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having me. Big fan of the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It might be kind of a basic question, but I was wondering how doctors can determine what other possible causes of multiple sclerosis symptoms, inflammatory disorders, structural damage in the brain. How do they differentiate those symptoms from multiple sclerosis and other diseases?
Especially since there's no test for MS.
Right.
You
right.
have to do it based on symptoms.
Right. Do you have any answer to this, Kumar?
No, that's exactly right. It would depend largely on symptomology and disease course. I mean, there are a lot of there are a lot of MS-like diseases out there. I mean, even something as basic as Lyme disease appears to present with a lot of symptoms that look like MS. There's actually not great tests right now for Lyme disease as well, except to try to identify the bacterium that causes it.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of multiple sclerosis, I mean, one of the better diagnostics has to do with a procedure that's a bit difficult, a lumbar puncture, where you're looking for banding patterns of proteins in the cerebrospinal fluid that appear to correlate with antibodies being produced in that fluid. And even that's not 100%. So it's a bit tricky. I think it's an unfortunate case that even patients, before they know have MS, don't recognize some of the early symptoms. And so it's not until you sort of have a second attack that real definitive diagnosis can occur. And frankly, that's an area of huge study right now. And it's a place where the Myelin Repair Foundation really wants to focus on trying to identify earlier stage biomarkers, not only for diagnostics, but also if we're able to identify therapies that we hope to be myelin reparative, that those same biomarkers would show us efficacy of those modifying therapies as we're doing clinical trials.
Right. Yeah, it seems the earlier, I've heard with a lot of the current treatments and therapies that we have now, the earlier we can catch it, the better the prognosis seems to be, the less damage there is that seems to be done. So
that because of the effectiveness of the therapies? Must be, right?
I think in the immunomodulatory reducing the number of attacks on the body. If you can keep the body from attacking itself, you're going to keep the amount of damage.
So you have effective therapies then.
There are some. There you know, not 100% for sure. And in terms of the diagnosis, Dr. Mom in the chat room says it is a diagnosis of exclusion.
Right.
That's exactly right.
Can't be anything else. Must be this.
Must be this. Right. And I just remember, you know, personal anecdote here. When my mom was diagnosed, it was at first she had some trouble playing the piano, and it was diagnosed as carpal tunnel. And so she actually, you know, that's what we thought it was for a long time. And then symptoms started to change a little bit. And so that's when the diagnosis changed. And it was years later that an MRI was actually done, and they actually saw physical damage. And so that was like, yeah, now we know for sure you have it. But that's exactly what it was a diagnosis of exclusion. Well, okay, that went away. So that's what this must be.
But it would have been nice to know sooner, because you could have treated it and reduced its severity.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What kind does your mom have?
My mom has a progressive form of MS.
Okay. Yeah. That's much more serious, isn't it, than remission. What is it?
Relapsing remitting.
Relapsing remitting.
Yeah. So Montel Williams, and some of the major celebrities, a couple. Montel Williams is one. Right. I think he has relapsing remitting. I can't remember the name of it. There's another celebrity out there. Valerie Bertinelli. Is that right? No. Am I right? Am I wrong?
I don't know if Valerie Bertinelli.
I don't think it's Valerie. I think, don't listen to me.
Let's not give her something she doesn't
know. I know. Don't listen to me there. There's another celebrity out there who has relapsing.
Does Michael J. Fox have MS?
He has Parkinson's
disease. Okay.
Yeah. Which, speaking of stem cell therapies, I thought it was interesting that you brought that up relating to multiple sclerosis, because I didn't realize that was being considered. I know for Parkinson's, that's something they've looked at a lot, and it's had kind of varying results, some really
bad
and some okay.
That's right.
The president on West Wing had relapsing remitting.
That's right.
Yeah.
A celebrity on TV.
On TV.
And in real life.
Annette Funicello.
It's good that they did that on West Wing, because I think that raised the awareness for a lot of people.
Yes. Yeah. And the majority of people seem to have the relapsing remitting form. That seems to be the primary form that I think it's like 90% to 95% of people who have MS. That's what they have. And so that's where actually the priority for a lot of these therapies and research is actually directed, because that's the majority of people and what they have.
Right.
It's a tricky situation. I think, you know, you're right. There's a very, very high proportion of people who present with relapsing remitting courses. But from what I understand, it also is the case that a number of these people with the RRMS form do convert to the secondary progressive form. And I think it has to do scientifically with the body not being able to fully repair the damage that has occurred. And so the hope is these immunomodulatory therapies, like you say, would lessen the course. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to think about ways to really affect repair, so to, again, get patients back to a state where they have, 100% function.
Yeah. Somebody in the chat room is asking, what area of the world has the highest MS occurrence? And I think it's actually the Northern Hemisphere, North America, actually.
It's purely anecdotal, but I know so many people who have it, and yep. It just seems like it's very widespread. What percentage of the population gets it, Kumar? Do you know?
I don't know the full percentages. I think the incidence rates in the U.S. Currently are in the 400,000 range, and worldwide, I think 2.5 million people. So. Okay. Yeah, I guess we could do the calculation of, six right. plus billion people right. and figure right. that one out.
It's not that common. It just seems like it is.
It does. I think everybody or a lot of people know somebody who's affected by multiple sclerosis, at least in the circles that I travel in. And I think that there are certainly environmental and geographic factors affecting the disease. And it's just yet another, layering of confusion on top of how we do the diagnosis, how we handle the modifying therapies, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very complicated disease.
Yeah, there's a... there's a map from Wikipedia that has a distribution of multiple sclerosis throughout the world, and it's pretty striking. At the Northern Hemisphere is the color goes from kind of gray for no data, light yellow, all the way up to red for the most cases, and the Northern Hemisphere is just orange and red. Huh. seems to be a very northern affliction. So maybe it is vitamin D.
Maybe it's vitamin D deficiency.
We just really don't know. Huh? We have no idea. Isn't that interesting?
No idea. So we know that it's Northern Hemisphere. We also know the majority of people who get it are women. So maybe there's a hormone basis to it.
Both guys I know who have it are men, obviously, because they're guys. But that's interesting. So women more preponderance in women.
More in females than in males.
And there are clinical trials, in fact, for estradiol in terms of trying to find out whether those therapies could be effective in women, because and a lot of women who undergo pregnancy while they have the disease apparently report that they've never felt better except when they were pregnant. And so there are some academic medical centers taking advantage of that and trying to go follow that line of study.
Could also be, you're pregnant and the wee one inside of you suppresses your immune system so that you don't attack it. Right. So it could be it's a natural immune suppression of pregnancy.
Right.
Could be hormones, could be these other things. This is just fascinating. Do we have any more calls or comments?
We don't.
Or is that it?
Okay. We don't. I have a Ford commercial, which I'd like to do.
Great.
And then I could talk briefly about that. We'll get back to more of...
I think we all have to wrap it up fairly soon.
Pretty soon. But we'll give you a little extra time because I ate into your time and I'm a bad, bad man. But we don't have our Twit holiday special is coming up in just a little bit. I do want to mention our friends at Ford who do the Sync My Ride stuff. The Sync is an amazing technology that goes in Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. In fact, if you're getting a new car, you should absolutely look at it. I have tried all the in-car hands-free systems, all the in-car audio systems, and this is the one you want. It has a USB connector, so you can connect almost any device to it. It also has an audio jack. That'll get everything else that doesn't have USB. It also bonds with your Bluetooth phones. I have 3 different phones. I know I'm not usual, but you can get up to 25 phones automatically connecting, and it does Bluetooth audio, which is fantastic. So when I get in the car, my music starts playing from my iPhone. It also gives you information, GPS, turn-by-turn directions, not with a big screen, but by talking to you. The whole idea is it's for safety. You keep your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road, and yet you can do all those things that you want to do in your car. You could say, play Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, number 27. You can say, play the Beatles, play Metallica, whatever. You can say, play next, play previous, stop. You could play similar. You have complete control of the climate. You can say, give me sports scores, movie times, fuel prices. You can navigate. It's just amazing. I mean, this is really the next generation of automotive computing, and it's right now in all Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. Find out more. Go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com. You can get a demo there. It'll take you over to the Sync My Ride site, which is the site for Sync owners. I get vehicle history reports, all sorts of things just from my car. And so I want you to try it out. SyncMyRidePodcast.com. We are so grateful to Ford for sponsoring all of our shows on Twitter, and especially Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Dr. Yeah, Kiki?
Especially Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Kumar, do you think there's going, I mean, just looking at it from a research angle and understanding, all the potential influences, the cellular, viral, genetic, to multiple sclerosis. Do you think it's going to be one cure-all? Are we going to find a silver bullet? Or do you think this is going to turn into lots of different research paths, go finding all sorts of things that we might mix and match?
I think it's a layering. I think today I wouldn't say we know enough about the basic biology to exclude the fact that there might be, a silver bullet. I think though what we would say by looking at all available current data is that there's probably probably some sort of combination therapy that we would have to use to really have the best impact on patients. Again, today, it's always this hope that we bring because, when the MRF was started and when we're looking at a lot of the data that are coming out now, there's still so many questions to be asked about how myelination occurs. I mean, because we didn't really touch on this too much, but the nerve cell around which this myelin sheath is made is not itself the cell that creates that sheath. That's a second cell, which is called an oligodendrocyte, and that cell needs to somehow be motivated to myelinate an axon. And in fact, that cell, as resident in the brain, is in a precursor state. So it itself needs to mature before it can go do its work. So there's so many basic questions about how differentiation and maturation of a precursor cell to an oligodendrocyte state occurs. So many questions about in longer term disease, are there effects of injury to the axon that in fact are inhibitory to that oligodendrocyte trying to myelinate? Is the scarring actually having some kind of physical impact on keeping that oligodendrocyte from finding the damaged nerve? Just so many basic questions that we just don't have answers to today. The hope really is that there would be some type of single therapy or, small combination of therapeutics that really has the major impact for all patient populations.
So is it daunting? Knowing there are so many questions, there are a lot of people working on these questions, but at the same time, is it ever just like, oh my gosh, we're never going to figure it out. Sometimes I feel that way about different diseases, and there's so much to learn.
It's interesting. If it ever is, I just go home and hang out with my family and remember why we're all doing this in the first place. So it's actually a unique aspect of the work that goes on at the Myelin Repair Foundation, because as a nonprofit, our focus is not necessarily the basic science, it's the patients and really bringing therapies to patients faster and trying to figure out ways to do that more efficiently. And so it can be. From a scientific perspective, it's all incredibly, incredibly interesting, and there's just beautiful science going on, and you can appreciate it from sort of the academic scientific perspective. But if you get tired, you feel daunted again. If you have these personal associations with these really horrible diseases, you just go home and hang out with your family a little bit and crack some jokes and just realize how brave these people are. And you can't help but to regain your faith and go back and work a little harder.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's probably a high note to leave this show on. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday season. Spend a lot of good quality time with your family. I'm going to go do the same. And
thank you.
Thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Happy holidays to you both. Happy holidays to all your listeners. And thank you so much for your interest in the Myelin Repair Foundation and learning more about MS.
MyelinRepair.org. Yeah.
That's right. And Kumar Hari was our guest today on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Thank you very much. You can find Dr. Kiki's Science Hour in iTunes. We have an RSS feed if you did not, if you're catching a rerun or you just caught this part right now, you can go download, you can download Dr. Kiki's Science Hour and back episodes.
There's four or five episodes now, so that's great.
There are a few episodes there to download. You don't just have to catch it live, although live is nice.
Live is good.
Next week, we will be talking we're going to be here on Wednesday morning.
Right, because we don't want to work Christmas Eve.
We're not going to work Christmas Eve. I'm going to be driving to visit my family to spend that good quality time Christmas Eve. But the day before Christmas Eve, we are going to be talking about the Ice Cube Project.
Sounds fitting,
right?
Yeah,
for the holiday season? Yeah. The Ice Cube Project is in a very cold place, Antarctica, and it's underground in Antarctica.
Even colder.
It's a giant underground freezing neutrino detector. We're going to be talking about neutrinos and detecting them using Antarctica, which will be a lot of fun. So that is what we're talking about next week. And for our New Year's show coming up, we can look forward to talking about time and the atomic clock. I'm lining up an interview with a scientist from the National Institute of Standards and Technologies to talk about the atomic clock. We're going to talk about atoms and stuff. You can find me online at drkiki.tv, at drkiki on Twitter. And if you want to ask a question about neutrinos, the Ice Cube Project, or even putting it forward to the atomic clock.
We didn't use Vidly today.
We tried the Talkin.
We can do Talkin' and Vidly.
Yes.
Why not? If you're sounding like a baby, you might as well go all the way.
And remember, if you're going to use Vidly and send me a video comment or question, please use the hashtag #DKSH for Dr. Kiki Science Hour.
Don't forget the evolution. What do they call it?
Evolvums.
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 Evolvums.com/twist. For a special discount.
Yeah.
What a good gift.
Twist, they're great for kids of all ages, like me.
I noticed you have quite a few.
They're all mine.
Is this your collection?
No, I'm giving a couple of these away. We actually are doing a giveaway on Twist this week in science, my radio show. We are, for people who write us Twistmas stories. They have to include evolution, ideas of evolution and Twistmas. And we had a really great and contest entry this last week, and so we already have one winner. This next week we'll be giving away.
Before Twistmas.
Yes.
And all through the house.
It was great.
All of them are rocking.
Yeah, we had the story of Kirk Cameron. I on the Twist website, twist.org, for the show notes this week, I put the entry. It's actually a brilliant poem.
Sounds great.
Loved it.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Evolvums.com/twist, 10% discount on these little cute little evolving animals. And that's it.
Thank you, Kiki. We're done.